Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to our brand new series of Kabbalah and Coffee. So the book that we're going to be studying is called The Majestic Bride. This is what it looks like. And we have some books on order. They'll be in by next Sunday. For today, we have the copies. Let's begin. The book is about, and really the series is about, love, relationships, intimacy, men and women, communication, giving, receiving, all of these wonderful themes. And there are many ways that we can approach relationships, many different starting points, many different contexts, many different areas of study. You can get any number of books on relationships, right? 7 tips to a better this, and 10 steps to a better that, and 365 days to an excellent the other, right? There's no end to the types of material that's out there. We have books, and we have articles, and we have seminars, and we have workshops, and all of this stuff, and it's all wonderful. But I think that Judaism, especially the works of Kabbalah, Judaism and Kabbalah have a very interesting and unique perspective on relationships. Good morning, Alex. I always say that Judaism looks at things from the inside out as opposed to the outside in. As human beings, the way we operate fundamentally is that we look at things from the outside in. First, you notice the outside of a thing, and then if you pay more attention, you get to know what's behind the surface. Even with regards, let's say, to a book. I mentioned books before, but even with a book, what's the first thing about a book that you notice? The cover. Now, we know the famous adage, don't judge a book by its cover. But if that were true, then all of the graphic designers that work on book jackets and illustration, right, they would all be out of business. We know the truth is that a good-looking outside of a book does sell more copies because people are drawn to the outside. And that's the way, and it's not a condemnation of the human condition. It's just stating the reality. The reality is that we look at things from the outside in. So when I held up this book and I mentioned that the balance of the books are coming by next week, they're still on their way. But this is the book that we're going to be studying. The first thing you noticed, of course, was the outside, was the picture. Maybe you're wondering, what is this picture? You see the title, The Majestic Bride. Maybe you're wondering what this picture is. It has some colors, a collage of colors, if you will, on the cover. But that's what you're noticing. You don't know yet what it says inside, because as human beings, we first look at the outside, and then we look at the inside. When we get to know people, first we get to know the outside of a person, and then, with time, we get to know the inside of a person. So that's the way it works, though. It works from the outside in. And so the same thing is true with science and other forms of exploration. As human beings, the way we get to know things is from the outside in. We first observe something on the outside, and then we probe deeper, we get deeper, we try to understand what makes it work, right? You look at the outside, this is what's happening. And then you say, well, why is it happening? So let's go a little bit deeper and deeper and deeper until we get to the core of things. So that's the way human sciences, the human mind works. All physical things work from the outside in. This is in stark contrast to Judaism, especially the works of Kabbalah, Jewish mysticism, that work from the inside out. So Kabbalah doesn't start from the outside and say, well, here's something that we observe. Let's figure out why it works like that. That's not how Kabbalah operates. Kabbalah is not observing things from the outside and then trying to get deeper, deeper inside through trial and error. I should mention through trial and error, because we don't really know if that's the truth behind it. I mean, even look at psychology. Let me just digress for a second and move away from Kabbalah. We'll get back to it. So even the psychologists, you have different fields of psychology. You have Freud, you have Adler, Frankl. You have different perspectives on what makes the human being tick, and it's trial and error. We think that this is what drives the external behavior, but this is our best guess, and each person might have a different guess or a different combination of guesses or attribute a different combination of factors as to why, what's going on the inside, as to give rise to what we're seeing on the outside. So the point is that human beings, we do our best, but we're working from the outside in. We're really, it's kind of like groping or grappling, if you will, in the dark, somewhat. Whereas Kabbalah and Judaism, especially Kabbalah, so Kabbalah operates from the inside out. Kabbalah speaks to the truth of a thing the way it is, because Kabbalah has access to the soul of a thing. Kabbalah doesn't have access only to the body of a thing, whatever that thing is, Kabbalah has access. Kabbalah speaks of the soul of that thing. And so here's the amazing thing. Once you understand the soul of a thing, so you can then work outside, work from inside out and understand, now I understand the soul of the thing. Now I understand why the manifestation on the outside is such. Because that's the way it's operating on the inside, so that's why it's operating like that on the outside. Because this is the way the mechanics work on a soul level or on a cosmic spiritual level, that's why on a physical level it appears on the surface as such. Make sense? So fundamentally, it's taking a look from a different perspective. As opposed to looking at the world from the outside in, which is peeling back layers and trying to guess as to what's the cause of what you're seeing. So Kabbalah is working from the inside out, telling you what the truth is, and then either telling you, spelling it out as to how it works out back in the layers and manifests on the external, or it leaves it up to our imagination, more than imagination, our extrapolation to figure out how we go from the soul of a thing to what we see on the outside. But the point is, it addresses the heart of the issue. So let's talk about our theme. Our theme is relationships. Our theme is relationships, love, intimacy, and I think intimacy is a word that I want to focus on. Because intimacy is a necessary ingredient for relationships that I think today is somewhat of a lost art. So what is intimacy? Intimacy implies closeness. We love many things. This is a theme I've talked about many times over the last 10 years. Love is a very vague word. And love doesn't really mean anything anymore. Why? Because you can say that you love someone, you love a human being, but you also say you love chocolate. So the word doesn't mean anything. When I say it doesn't mean anything, what I mean is it's lost its meaning because we use love for so many different things. Right? What does it mean that you love chocolate? What does it mean that you love sushi? What does it mean that you love a good wine? What does it mean that you love music? What does it mean that you love a human being? These are different types of love. But we use the same word, and that's a problem. The problem is not, I mean, there's no language, no, I'm not being a language police. Everyone can use whatever word they want. The problem is for us, because what it does is it clouds for us what it means to really love someone else. What does that mean? Do I love another person the same way I love all of the other things that I mentioned? Or is it fundamentally different? And if it's fundamentally different, do we have language? And language, it's not about semantics. Do we have a framework for ourselves to understand and articulate in our own mind? You see, language is powerful because language not only expresses to someone else what we're thinking, language can express to ourselves what we're thinking. Language expresses, reveals to ourselves how we think and what we're thinking. When you think of something, you're typically thinking in a language. You ever notice that? You're thinking in English? Yes? That's the only language you know. But what I'm saying is, do you notice that you think in a language, in an actual language? Like when you think, you process, the Kabbalah says, we think in terms of letters. Osiot, letters, letters. Letters and words and paragraphs. And again, we typically think that letters and language, they're only useful when needing to communicate to someone else. So if I need to share what's inside my head with someone else, so I need a language, I need a structure, I need a formula through which, by which, in which to express those ideas or feelings. Kabbalah teaches the first modality, the first stage of revelation through language is to ourselves. That's why machshava, thought, is considered one of the levushei hanefesh, one of the garments of the soul. Thought is not the soul itself. Thought is counted as one of the levushei hanefesh, one of the garments of the soul. A garment is something that conceals, that covers, but also reveals. And so thought is the first step in self-revelation. There's an idea in your head, in your mind, that you're not even aware of. The first moment that you become aware of it, when you begin becoming consciously aware of that idea or that feeling that you may have but not be aware of it, that first step from the subconscious into consciousness, into conscious thought, that's called thought. And that's where letters begin. And so if we think of love, if we think of relationships and connections between us and other human beings, if we think of that in language terms of love, and we also think of sushi, our desire for sushi, in the same language in our own minds, so what that does is it doesn't only confuse the other party, it confuses ourselves. Because what is the distinction? If we can't articulate the distinction to ourselves, what indeed is the distinction? So a person will say, no, I love sushi, but I really love my spouse. I really love my child. I really love my parent. Okay, so is it a matter of degree? Is there no fundamental distinction? Is it just a matter of, it's like a dimmer, it's like a sliding scale. It's like, so for the food, or for the music, or for the musical, or for the movie, so it's at 50%, 60%, 70%. But for my loved one, so it's 90%, 100%, it's really, or is there something more fundamental? So Judaism teaches that there's something much more fundamental. When it comes to human relationships, especially the closest of human relationships, so there's a better word. Again, it's not just about the semantics, it's about articulating the distinction for ourselves. So instead of love, we can use the word intimacy. Intimacy implies a deep closeness that doesn't exist with the other types of love that I mentioned before. So you can love... you can love a car, but hopefully you don't have a sense of intimacy with that car. Hopefully. You never know. But I'm saying hopefully it's a different type of love, because love is thrown around, so hopefully we wouldn't use that word, intimacy, together with the other things. A car, a piece of sushi, etc. So what is intimacy? So here's the challenge with intimacy. Intimacy implies a very deep closeness. So we live in a world today, in a society today, that almost devalues very deep connections. And why do I say devalues? I don't mean that you and I can't appreciate it or don't desire these types of deep connections. But I think that as human beings, we live in a society where it's the very quick, superficial, short types of connections that are promoted as being the touch points. So it's like the way our brain is being rewired now with Facebook and other forms of communication, media and texting and all this stuff. So the way our brains are being wired are very short, quick hits. It's like a very short and superficial hit. So we could have many friends on Facebook and many connection points, but the question is, are they really deep, intimate relationships? And I'm not suggesting that we need to have deep and intimate relationships with many, many people, but at least with those people that we should have a deep, intimate relationship with, we should have that. So the question is, are we, it's a question to think about for ourselves, are we kind of positioning ourselves, the reality with everything around us, where our relationships are being kind of reduced to these very quick touch points of contact and kind of missing the deeper intimate connections that we need. And I would posit that, yes, that's a problem. Facebook now, Facebook is going through they're in hot water for various things. Yeah, lots of tsars. Okay, so that's that. But lately, in the last few years, so if you've navigated Facebook, so you'll notice that it used to be you could just like something, but now it's more than like. What can you do now? If you hold it down, huh?
And you can love it.
You can love it. You can love it. You can be sad about it, and you can love it. And what I'm saying is, liking. Okay, at least they didn't touch the holy grail of love, but now they took that also. They took love. Where else are they going next? Intimacy. They're gonna have an intimacy button. Right? Like a really close connection. Huh?
Don't give them any ideas.
What I'm saying is, they've taken love and they've made love a click away. So we can't use that anymore. It's done. It's finished. You can't. Love doesn't mean anything anymore. It doesn't mean anything, but it doesn't mean what it should mean. So that's what I mean. We need to have different language to express deeper connections. It's something that you can just click. Love, a click away. It's like, is that really love? Is that really that type of love that we're speaking, that we're looking for? So, so let's talk about intimacy. So what does it mean? Intimacy is a deep connection that is, I'm not going to say it's deeper than love, but it's deeper than the love, the word, that construct that I think we're throwing around today. Intimacy is much deeper. Intimacy implies a closeness, the deepest closeness that two people can have. Now, again, because we're human beings, so it's easy to focus on the expressions of that. So there are expressions, physical expressions of intimacy, of the deepest connection between two human beings. But again, as human beings, our tendency is to look from the outside in, and sometimes we get stuck on the outside. The question is not what's an external, if you will, expression of intimacy. The question is, what is at the soul of intimacy? What does it mean to be connected with somebody? Not what's the outside, the outward manifestation or expression of that intimacy, but how does one build or create intimacy with another human being? How do we get that sense of closeness with another human being? So that's one area that we're going to explore throughout this series as we study this book, The Majestic Bride. Another area of focus. So that's introduction number one. Number two, gender roles and gender definitions. So the reality today is that this is a very fluid conversation, right? When we talk about gender, it's very complicated. It's a very complicated conversation. It's complicated on multiple levels. If you filled out a form lately, I've seen forms even with my kids. It's not the question of gender anymore. It's a question of what gender do you associate or identify as, etc. So gender, I think more than ever, probably in human history, gender is somewhat of a fluid conversation. You know, I think for a while, gender's gone through a lot of, it's been through a lot. I think even today, you know, when we talk about men and women. So women didn't have the ability to vote in the United States till when? Till the 20s. Yeah. So we've had issues with gender, right? I mean, we've had, as a nation, we've had challenges. Right? Declaration of Independence says we believe that all men are created equal. What does that actually mean? All men or all human beings? All free white men? Like, what does it actually mean? Right? It's a very nice statement. All men are created equal. But yet, what does it actually mean? Okay. So again, gender's been through a lot of challenges. And there's been times where there's been oppression from one gender to another. And I think even today, not even today, but today there's too much of that going on. And then we have the idea of equality of genders. But is equality really equality? And is equality sameness or is it difference but equal? Right? Different but equal. Many different kinds. And then, like I said, today it's even another conversation. It's even, is a gender or is it something that a person chooses and identifies as? So this it's a very complicated topic. You know, you thought, you know, back in the day, boys and girls, right? It's not so easy today. It's not so simple. It's not simple. So the question is, what does Kabbalah say about gender? If you cut all the politics and all of the, I mean, like politics, all the social politics, cut away all the outside in stuff. At the core of it, what is gender? So Kabbalah speaks of masculine energies and feminine energies. So we're going to explore throughout this text as well, what is masculine energy? What is feminine energy? Who has masculine energy and feminine energy? And we'll discover that men and women have both. And how does it play an important role in relationships and in the creation of a healthy intimacy between two people? So we're going to cover that as well in this series. And then the final area that we're going to explore is the notion of giving and receiving. Now, so sounds like give and take, and there's some of give and take involved with this, but it's much more than that. As we'll discover throughout the next several weeks, giving and receiving is an art unto itself. There's an art of giving, and there's an art of receiving. It's not so simple. And how we give and how we receive plays a fundamental role in determining the nature of a relationship. Every relationship has giving and receiving. Whether it's parents and children, whether it's a teacher and student, whether it's husband and wife, whether it is whatever it is. There's always giving and always receiving. And think about it in this way. In any conversation, there's giving and receiving. One person is speaking, and the other person is listening. So there's giving and receiving. And then the other person speaks, and they're giving, and the other one is receiving. If we don't know how to give, and we don't know how to receive, so then we can't really be in a close relationship. If we say, and I don't want to reduce a relationship to this, but if we say that a primary skill in relationships is communication, and I would agree with that. I'm not going to say it's the primary skill, but it's a primary skill. If we say that that communication is critical to relationship, so then how can we have healthy communication if we don't know how to give and we don't know how to receive? So giving and receiving is not just something we do or something that we do subconsciously that we're not even aware of. It becomes something that needs a lot of focus and a lot of training and a lot of knowledge and awareness. What does it mean to give? What does it mean to receive? I'll give you the Hebrew words for this. In the Hebrew, in Kabbalah, it's called, the giver and the receiver, those two roles. And again, in a conversation, those hats are being switched. So one moment, I'm the giver, you're the receiver. The next moment, you're the giver and I'm the receiver. And that's a healthy modality of conversation. But the giver is called the mashpia. Mashpia is the one who's giving. And the mekabel is the one who is receiving. By the way, mekabel sounds like Kabbalah, but it's a different form of the word. Mekabel is the one who is, mekabel means the receiver. Kabbalah means the received wisdom. So Kabbalah is received wisdom from on high. But even that word implies that God, if you will, is giving the wisdom. It's divine wisdom, right? So what's the origin? The origin is God. It's divine. So God is giving the wisdom, and we are Kabbalah. We're receiving the wisdom. You have to know how to give and how to receive. If you don't know how to give and don't know how to receive, you're not going to have a healthy relationship. You won't create a healthy intimacy, a closeness between yourself and another without these skills of giving and receiving. It's a fundamental skill that, again, is not discussed. I don't think you're going to walk into Barnes & Noble and see a book called How to Be a Mashpia and How to Be a Mekabel. You're not going to have that. It's not going to be. You'll have books on communication and books on other things, other areas of relationships. But again, Kabbalah speaks of the core, the soul. What's at the core? What's at the core of communication? It's not just communication. It's not just words. I mean, there are other ways to communicate. You can communicate through body language. You can communicate in many different ways. So it's not just speaking. It's not just communicating verbally. It's about giving and receiving. There's an art. There's a science behind. There's a spiritual science behind giving and receiving. So in this course, in this series of classes, Kabbalah and Coffee on the Majestic Bride, we're going to get into this as well. So we have three topics. Number one, what is intimacy? And how is it created? How is it strengthened? Number two, gender or gender energies. What is masculinity? What is femininity? What are these energies? and where are they, how do they work? And number three, what does it mean to give? What does it mean to receive? How do we give and how do we receive in a healthy way? Make sense so far? So that's the overview. That's the overview. And by the way, if you have all of these things, not only defined in your mind, but if you're working to implement these teachings in your character and in your life, then the idea is that you're going to be having much healthier relationships. If you know what it means to have a true intimacy with someone else on a soul level, if you know what masculinity is and femininity is in these energies, if you know what it means to give and what it means to receive and how to do both, if you know all of this and you begin practicing it, then from the inside out, there's going to be healing or improvement in our relationships. That's the nature of it. One more point on the inside out versus the outside in. It just came to me now. I think I used the word healing. So there's two ways to practice medicine. One way is to treat the symptom. That's working from the outside in. So you see a symptom comes up. Let's get rid of the symptom. There's another form of medicine where you're not just treating the symptom, you're treating the cause. There are many letters of the Lubavitcher Rebbe about medicine, about healing, about sickness and health, etc., about that topic. Why? Because as Rebbe, as the Lubavitcher Rebbe, the Rebbe received, I don't know how many, a very, very large number, a vast number of letters and correspondences about health. People wrote in to the Rebbe asking for blessings for good health. Somebody's sick, God forbid, diagnosed with something, etc., 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 and they would write a letter for a blessing. You know, you go to one of the age-old practices of Judaism is you ask a tzaddik for a bracha, you ask a righteous person for a blessing. So, in addition to the spiritual stuff, the Rebbe would often encourage the individual to seek help, to seek care holistically. I don't mean any specific, when I say holistic, I don't mean, holistic medicine. That's not what I mean. What I mean is treating the entirety of the person. Don't just get the outside checked out, but address what's going on with your life. How's your spiritual state? Right? How are your relationships? Right? What's going on in your life? What's the totality? You know, so the Rebbe would say, are you putting on tefillin? Are you lighting Shabbat candles? Are you praying? Right? What's going on a spiritual level? Because that will affect the outside. I would hope that by now, you know, we've all seen the world for a number of years. We've been around the block a few times. We've seen things. And we know that what happens inside, not physically, but what happens inside, it's all physical, I guess, but what happens inside affects the outside. Right? You can have stress, and that affects that gives you a physical symptom on the outside. But why? It's like an emotional thing. Why should the emotion affect physical stuff? But it does. You know, your skin could break out in physical stuff because you have at this point in history, in our life, for us individually, we know this. This is not like some sort of pseudoscience that, you have to take care of your spiritual side as well in addition to the physical. We know this is true. How we feel inside, our sense of well-being and inner health affects our literal outside, external, medical checkup, if you will, health. Make sense? So, addressing the inside is one of the most, is probably the surest way to ensure outside health as well. Because you can treat the outside, but all you're doing is playing a game of whack-a-mole, where if something comes up, you're stopping that, but then something else is going to come up, because there's an underlying ailment, if you will, that is bubbling to the surface. Whereas if you address the core of it, so then you're doing a better job. So, by the way, in this context, the Rebbe wrote letters to patients. By the way, the Rebbe would never call someone a patient, because patient implies sickness. So the Rebbe would tell doctors, don't call them patients. Don't think of them as patients. Think of them as human beings right? Don't think in that, even the, again, language matters. And how we think about it kind of shifts the way we approach things. So the Rebbe would tell people that were healing, in the process of healing, and would tell doctors that were helping those people along in that process, the Rebbe would tell both to look at the deeper things. The Rebbe would tell doctors, is make sure that your practice, that your office, that your communication is in a way that you're encouraging the soul of the person, the way that you're encouraging the inner parts of the person. Are you addressing, are you speaking in a sensitive way that uplifts a person and makes them feel better from the inside out, because that's going to speed up their healing process. And the Rebbe would speak to people on that process themselves and encourage them as well, as I mentioned before, various mitzvot things and other types of study things to put positive messages in front of a person, and that heals a person, helps heal a person from the inside out. Obviously, there are things that need to be done from the outside in as well, simultaneous. Right? If somebody, God forbid, breaks an arm, so you don't say, well, let's just heal the soul and the arm will also set. You need to put the arm in a cast. Right? And likewise, with other physical things, you have to address the outside, the pragmatic part of it as well. But nonetheless, the true healing comes from the inside. And true healing comes from healing, if you will, or health of spirit creates health of body, etc. So when we talk about relationships, which this series is about. So we can try to patch on the outside. We could try to patch things. We put a band-aid on this issue. So we have an issue in the relationship, this manifestation. So the communication is not going so well. Or this becomes an issue. That flares up. The other thing flares up. So we could put patches, band-aids. Band-aid here, band-aid here. So we patch this one. Oh, everything's good. Oh, something else flares up. Let's patch that. Oh, another thing. Let's patch that. You end up with a lot of patches, and maybe patching things forever, and it's never truly the way we would like it to be. But if we study Kabbalah, and we address the soul of relationships, the soul of intimacy, the mystical art of love and intimacy, and gender roles, and gender energies, and giving and receiving, when we address the soul of these matters, so then it's much more powerful, and it truly creates a healthier state. Not from the outside in, patchwork style, but from the inside out. Make sense?
It's pretty obvious, but I just thought when you mentioned about emotions affecting physicality, I've seen that your spiritual well-being affects your emotions.
Yeah.
So that, it's a cascade.
Right.
That starts with your connection.
Yep. And the physical affects the emotion. Sorry, the spiritual affects the emotional.
Yes.
And the emotional affects the physical. It's all mind, body, soul. Again, the Rebbe was very much into this connection between mind, body, and soul. I encourage everyone to take a few moments at some point this week and Google Chabad.org. Rebbe's letters on healing. That's all you need to do. And it'll come up. You'll see a section on Chabad.org, various letters of the Rebbe to people and doctors, to people in the healing process and doctors. And it's you read it, and it's unbelievable.
What's the healing letter?
I don't know. These are the, just, I would Google this, Chabad.org.
Oh, Chabad.
Yeah, Chabad.org. And then, yeah. Yeah, and just type in Rebbe's letters on healing, and you'll get, I'm pretty sure there's a whole section that they collected, either English letters or they translated it from the Hebrew or the Yiddish, letters of the Rebbe about healing, what it means to heal for the individual and for doctors, for hospitals, for everybody involved in the healing process. What does it mean? And it wasn't like the Rebbe sent out letters like, here's what we need to do. It was in response to people's questions. Like people said, I'm struggling with this, or I'm suffering with that, or I've been diagnosed with the other. It was a doctor saying, what's the best way to heal this patient? What did he say?
I'm just thinking that doctors, I was going to say something about your
question,
but I just
went
to the emergency room, and they do none of that.
Okay, so again, it's not about a condemnation of so what I'm saying is, read these letters, even a few. You will it's so refreshing and so uplifting and so, I think, transformative to read the Rebbe's approach. It's really the Kabbalistic, it's the Torah, it's the Jewish approach, it's the Torah's approach, it's the Kabbalistic, the Hasidic approach to healing, and it's all about the inside out. Okay. So let's prepare, let's get ready for to jump into this book. Let me give you a little bit of an introduction. So this book contains two mystical texts, two Hasidic discourses. Two expositions, Kabbalistic expositions. One was authored in 1929 or 1928, and the other was authored in 1954. There's a genre of mystical texts that are associated with weddings. So at various weddings, I'm talking about the Chabad Kabbalistic texts, the Chabad Hasidic texts. So there's a whole genre of discourses that were authored and or recited in the context of weddings. Family weddings, other weddings. So at weddings, it was a good opportunity to share a mystical insight, a Hasidic discourse. So before us, we have the first of the two discourses is a mimer, is a Hasidic discourse, a Kabbalistic text that was written, it was penned in 1928, right before 1929, December of 28, in conjunction with the wedding of the Lubavitcher Rebbe. And was penned by his soon-to-be father-in-law, the previous Chabad Lubavitch Rebbe. So a little bit of history. Chabad was founded formally by the Alter Rebbe, Rabbi Schneer Zalman of Liadi, who was born in 1745 and passed away in 1812. So the Hasidic movement started with the Baal Shem Tov, continued with the Maggid of Mizrich and others, and then continued, at least the Chabad, the specific Chabad branch of Hasidism, continued with, or kind of began, a new branch began with the Alter Rebbe, Rabbi Schneer Zalman of Liadi. There were seven in that chain. The sixth was Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson, who passed away in 1950. He began in Russia. Then he got kicked out of Russia after the rise of communism. He moved to Europe, to Poland, spent 10 years in Poland, and then moved to New York, Crown Heights, Brooklyn. He was in Brooklyn before Brooklyn was so cool. Now Brooklyn is cool. Brooklyn is like the hottest, right? Brooklyn's hotter than Manhattan. Crown Heights now is also. Crown Heights is like hopping, moving and shaking. You can't buy a house in Crown Heights now. It's like, it's crazy. So it's like Crown Heights is the new Williamsburg. And Williamsburg is like, you know, we all know that that's, you know, super eclectic and everything. Anyway, so the previous Rebbe, so he moved to America in 1940. 1950 he passed away. And I'll say our Rebbe, the seventh Rebbe, our Rebbe, so he began officially accepted the mantle of leadership of Chabad Lubavitch in the year 1951. So at the Rebbe's wedding in 1928, his father-in-law, his soon-to-be father-in-law, Michelle, if you want, you can use the office. Huh? Oh, so tell him to switch. Yeah. So at the wedding in 1928, so the previous Rebbe, who was then the Rebbe, so Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson, he authored and taught three Hasidic discourses. The one that we're going to learn, that we're about to start, is the middle of the three. And it was said at the Kabbalah's Panim. Now, I'm going to explain what that is. It's part of the wedding. It's part of the wedding ceremony. Yeah, procedural, whatever. And I'll explain what that is. But again, let's talk about the mystical part of it. So the Hasidic masters would share Hasidic discourses on occasion, special occasions, maybe not so special occasions, but they were always special occasions. At a wedding, it was a specific time, to share Hasidic discourses. And, you know, the way it is that when a person is in a state of joy, so things flow in a different way. When you're excited about something, so the things that you're doing happen on a different level than when you're not so excited about something, right? When you're excited and motivated, so it comes with an enthusiasm and a power and an energy that you don't have without that joy and excitement. So it's of particular interest to study the wedding discourses because they were said in the context of a joyous occasion. His daughter is getting married. His daughter is about to get married. And so it's a very powerful time that the Hasidus, the teachings were on a very deep level, a very high level, a very joyous level, and studying it is a pleasure as well. So that's that context. Let's talk about the wedding ceremony and when this was said. So there are many components, several components to a Jewish wedding. So we're not talking about the engagement. That's, you know, that happens at a certain point in time, and a wedding date is set. Let's talk about day of the wedding. What happens day of wedding in a traditional, you know, let's talk about the traditional way of Jewish weddings. So we have a few pieces. Number one is the ketubah, is the marriage document. So the first thing that happens is, at least the first necessary piece, you know, you could have cocktails and hors d'oeuvres, I mean, that's whatever. But the first necessary piece is the ketubah, the marriage document and the contract. And that's an age-old legal document that is discussed in Jewish law and the Talmud and other sources, so it goes back a few thousand years, that in essence protects the wife in the marriage. The husband can't just unilaterally say, that's it, I'm divorcing you and moving on and whatever, and that's it, and I'm finding someone else, and, you know, leaving his wife, you know, out, you know, just abandoning her. So legally he can't do that. There is a ketubah contract that stipulates that he's on the hook for at least financially for a large chunk of gelt. Now, and it, huh? Yeah, I mean, the ketubah, the way it was written then, you know, listen, cost of living changes, right? So what was, but the way the ketubah was originally written was a decent sum of money. So now, should it be updated with more size? Some do update it a little bit and add more, you know, like a rider, if you will, on top of the ketubah. There's, whatever it is, there's different things that are done today. But the ketubah in concept is to provide security for the wife, that the husband can't just, you know, say, that's it, you know, I'm leaving or I'm divorcing you and leave her high and dry. Especially if you consider the way society existed for millennia, where the husband was the primary breadwinner. This is the way it worked for centuries, right? And the wife was typically not necessarily the breadwinner outside the home. And so for a husband to pick up and leave would be potentially very difficult, very harmful to the wife. So there was a protection. So the ketubah, at the core of it, I think maybe some think of it today as a love document, pledging the commitment between both parties. It's really not what it is. It's straight up a legal document. It's like a prenuptial, I mean, if you think of it. But it's mainly from husband to wife, saying that if this marriage does not, you know, at some point if it ceases, if the marriage doesn't continue or whatever after a certain point, so then I am pledging, I'm on the hook for all this stuff. And also, by the way, the husband pledges in the ketubah that to take care, before that obviously, to take care of his wife with all of his resources, to share everything that he has. And it says in the Aramaic, and I forget the actual terms, but glima I think is the word, to the shirt off my back, the husband pledges. Like literally everything that the husband has, he's pledging to not keep things for himself, but to share it with his wife and take care of his wife. And then if something, you know, if it, whatever, doesn't work out, then he's pledging a financial commitment to his wife. And that's the ketubah. So the first thing that happens at a traditional Jewish wedding is the signing of the ketubah. And that's a legal, it's a legal thing. There are two witnesses. So there's a rabbi that's making sure everything is done kalacha, like in accordance with Jewish law. There are two witnesses, kosher witnesses. The groom, it's, again, a traditional ketubah is the husband to the wife. So he's the only one that needs to sign it because it's his pledge to her. Today, there are different ketubah is like, one, I have to mention one other thing. Many people will put a ketubah on the wall and hang it up. And that's fine, but you should know what a ketubah is. It's not necessarily a love document. It's a financial, it's a prenup. It's saying if it doesn't work out, this is the stuff. In Jewish law, for husband and wife to live together, physically live together in the same house, under the same apartment, under the same roof, she has to have a ketubah. If it's misplaced, they cannot live in the same under the same roof. You understand, to the extent that the rabbis wish to protect the wife in this arrangement. There's no monkey business from the husband. If there's no ketubah, if the wife doesn't know where the ketubah is, if she doesn't have at any moment that protection of that document, the husband cannot live under the same roof. Rent a hotel, get a hotel room or whatever it is, cannot live under the same roof according to strict Jewish law, because she has to have a ketubah. So many, you know, I guess it is a good idea to put it on the wall because then you know where it is. Some people put it in books. The problem with that is that I just got a text of a picture from my mother-in-law in South Africa. She's a teacher in one of the largest Jewish day school in Johannesburg, and a kid brought in a chumash, Bible, a chumash, a Torah, a book to class, to school, and in it is the parents' ketubah. And it's like, okay, make sure it gets back to them safe and sound. But sometimes you put it in a book and then it gets on the shelf and you forget which book it's in and then it can go missing. And the point is, it's very important. So the first thing that's done, let's get back to the ceremony. The first thing that's done at a wedding ceremony is the ketubah. So the rabbi will usually explain to the husband, to the groom, what it says, because it's written in Aramaic traditionally. So explain exactly what it says, what he's on the hook for. Hook for, it doesn't sound right. It doesn't sound nice. Sorry. What he's committing himself to, right? You know, what he's obligating himself to, what it states in it, etc. And then he has to acknowledge, consent, that he's consenting to be obligated in that. And he says yes, but in order to effectuate it, so he has to make a kinyan. A kinyan is a form of acquisition. He has to acquire that liability. He has to acquire the responsibility. And that's typically done. We do it today with a kinyan chalipin, which means you do a switch. He acquires something, and as he acquires that physical thing, he also acquires the financial liability or the obligation that's written in the ketubah. And so the rabbi will typically give the groom a kippah or something, or a handkerchief. He'll pick it up. And we say, as you acquire this, you know, as you make a kinyan, one of the forms of acquisition is lifting up something. So as you acquire this physical thing, you're also acquiring the monetary amounts, etc., that are stipulated in the ketubah contract. So after that, the witnesses witness that commitment that the groom took, and they'll sign on the ketubah. Done. Ketubah is ready to go. Fine. So,
Does that stand up?
So I don't know. I don't know. I would like to think that some courts will defer to a Jewish document that was written and was consented and witnessed. It was acknowledged. It was understood. It was consented. It was signed. It was witnessed, etc. I would like to think that. I don't know. I've heard of courts that will defer to the Jewish courts. I don't know. Maybe in New York it's different. I don't know. Whatever it is, it's a good question. I can't speak definitively yes or no on that. And it might be your mileage may vary on that depending where you are. You know, like in Brooklyn, they might know more about that and be more familiar with that and be like, yeah, we know what that is. You need to take care of it on that level. Whereas in other places, they may be like, well, what is that? That doesn't have any legal validity. Does it essentially have legal validity? I don't know. We have to ask a lawyer to see if a document that has signatures on it from witnesses in a different language would have, right, if it's a contract, although it's signed in a different Hebrew or Aramaic, it should have, right, it should theoretically have that type of validity. Again, I don't, again, your mileage may vary as to, I can't speak confidently about the legal and judicial part of it. But anyway, but this is the, okay, so that's the first step of the ceremony. Now, the next part of a traditional Jewish wedding is like this. So the groom typically will have one room where his reception, if you will, is taking place. The bride will have another space where her reception is taking place. I don't mean reception. It's like, you know, her friends and family are there, and his friends and family are with him. And then, at a certain point in time, we have what is called the Kabbalas Panim, or the Badekin. What is that? So the guests will gather around the groom and then walk the groom to the bride, and the groom, upon reaching where the bride is sitting, will take the veil and place the veil, cover the eye, cover the bride with the veil. So that's known as the Kabbalas Panim, which literally means, again, Kabbalah, right? Kabbalas Panim, receiving of the face. What's the receiving of the face? It's kind of like the welcoming of the other person. So it's where the groom receives, like receives, like when you receive guests, it's kind of, so receives the face, if you will, the presence of the bride. So, but again, the way it works practically is the guests gather around the groom. The groom then walks over to the bride, veils the bride, and then the groom goes to the chuppah, stands under the canopy, and then the bride makes her way over to the chuppah as well. So that's the order of things. People go to the groom, they all go to the bride, the groom goes to the chuppah, the bride goes to the chuppah. Oh, and when the groom goes to the bride, so he puts on the veil. Why the veil? So that's a tradition that goes back to the very first Jewish wedding as discussed in the Torah, the wedding of Yitzchak and Rivka, Isaac and Rebekah. And the Torah tells us that Rebekah, upon seeing... No, I'm sorry. I think it does state it there. That she covered her face with a veil. Erica, can you pass a chumash right behind you? It's one of those, the brown, very worn covers. Anyone will do? Yeah. And then just pass it around. Oh, thank you. Hand-to-hand delivery, thank you. Okay, so here's what it says. So Yitzchak, Isaac lived in Israel, and Rebekah lived outside of Israel. And so Abraham's servant, it's a long story, Abraham's servant, his trusted sidekick, if you will, Eliezer, he went to find the shidduch, find a good match, marriage partner for Isaac. So he goes outside of Israel, finds Rebekah, Rivka, and he brings her back. So the Torah describes the first meeting. So Yitzchak went out to pray in the field towards evening. He looked up and saw, look, camels were approaching. This is his soon-to-be bride approaching. Rebekah looked up and saw Yitzchak, and she was stunned by his appearance, in a good way. I don't think it's like, hey, that's the guy I'm coming to. This is before Facebook, so she didn't really know what he... She lowered herself from the camel and said to the servant, who is that man walking in the field toward us? Like, who is that? Who's that guy? The servant said, he is my master. That's the guy. She took the veil and covered herself. So first Jewish wedding, first chassidim, first Jewish wedding in history. And we see the bride, if you will, covers herself with the veil. And then they got married. The narrative continues. So in tradition, in homage, if you will, to that tradition. So there's the bride wears a veil. Do brides wear veils in other traditions? In general, in America, do brides wear a veil? Is that a thing that's done? Where does that come from? Well, so I know where it comes from in the Torah. I mean, this is our ancient document. This is our history book. Why do we do it? Because our ancient bubby, our great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandmother, she did it, so we do it. That's what we do. That's what we do. But I don't know why it's done. It's a fashion thing. It's nice to know, though, the spiritual, or the biblical, the Jewish origins of a thing. This is the first time that we find the notion of a veil. By the way, another time that we find it ended up in a bit of a tricky situation. If you remember the next generation, so Isaac, so then Jacob, right? Three, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. So Jacob, Yaakov, he gets married to, well, he was thinking he was going to get married to a girl named Rachel, Rachel. And, you know, he asked for her hand in marriage. He asked her father for his daughter's hand in marriage. And the father said, yes, but you need to work 7 years. You need to work in my business. You have to be my shepherd. And then I'll give you my daughter. I'll let you marry my daughter. He was a tough father-in-law. If you think you have a tough father-in-law, Laban was the worst. Anyway, he was the toughest. So he 7 years, he puts in the work. And at the end of 7 years, the wedding happens, and there was a veil. And he thought he was marrying Rachel. He gets home, and next thing you know, who did he marry? Leah. He ended up marrying Rachel as well, whatever. He married two sisters, which today is, yeah. According to Torah law, by the way, you can't do that. But this was before the Torah was given at Sinai, before the rules were given. And even though the patriarchs try to keep as much as they could, but again, he promised the one sister that he would marry her, Rachel, and he ended up marrying Leah. He felt it wasn't right to not go through with his marriage of Leah, which he is married, to divorce her, and he had pledged to Rachel that he would marry, to Rachel that he would marry her, so he ended up marrying both, and that's the rest is history. But the point is, how did he not know who it was, which sister that he was marrying? So we say that one of the answers that are given is that that she was wearing a veil. Now that's a veil, right? Talk about an opaque veil. It's not one of those see-through veils like a mesh. Sister, I don't know how much. I mean, who knows, right? Who knows exactly how closely they look like each other? But the
my daughter's getting married.
Mazel tov. Right.
Because they all these florists we go to, they have these art.
The canopy.
And I'm like, no. We have it first.
Right. By the way, the chuppah itself, why do we have that canopy? So that we'll actually get into that in this text. But you're right. A lot of the things have been adopted, borrowed, or whatever. But it's cool to know the actual origins. Yeah.
Well, I think it's more done out of tradition because it says, what is the origin of a wedding veil?
Yeah. Interesting. An evolution. On a spiritual level, though, I mean, that's whoever wrote that, but on a spiritual level, there's a lot of meaning and significance in it. So one insight, I'll just share with you an insight that's just, I would say, parenthetical to this. So usually when I officiate at a wedding, I'll mention this insight, that when it comes to the veil, the message is, well, in thinking about it now, it's actually the message that I've been sharing all this morning, that you can either look at the outside or you can look at the inside. And the message to the groom, to the husband-to-be, or to the husband is, I think I probably mentioned this, yeah, is, you can look at the outside, or you can connect with who the person is on the inside. And I think for men, there's a particular challenge of getting stuck on the outside stuff. women in general, in Judaism at least, Kabbalah speaks of this as well, women are more spiritual, which means that they can see, I guess you can't paint everything with a broad brush, but you know, your mileage may vary, but in general, women or the feminine energy, women have a more are more apt or more prone to be able to see the core of a thing, the inside of a thing, and take less note of the outside of a thing. Not that they don't notice the outside of a thing, but it's easier to get to the point sometimes, easier to get to the core, to the soul of a matter. Whereas guys, I don't know, guys get stuck on the outside. Guys, oh, sports cars, oh, like flashy. Again, not all guys, and not everyone is the same, but whatever. But in general, guys are more external, visual, and women are a little bit deeper. So, especially for a guy, for the groom, for the husband, the deeper message of the veil is that I'm not just marrying you for your external beauty, because I actually can't see your external beauty right now, especially if it's an opaque veil. In fact, Jacob's like, I don't even know who I'm marrying. I'm kidding. No, not to that extent, right? We should know who we're marrying, right? That's why it's the husband that walks, the Kabbalah Spanim, walks to the groom, walks to the bride, and puts the veil on. So the groom says, yes, I know who's under the veil. So the point is that the declaration is, I love you, not just the outside, not just the external. I don't just love your appearance and outside beauty, etc., but rather I love you for who you are inside. So that's a little bit of a deeper perspective on the veil. Could it be modesty as well? I guess, but I think there's, especially when you learn Kabbalah, there's a lot of deeper messages. But now, so that's the kind of the preliminaries. You sign the ketubah, the guests welcome the groom and the guests welcome the bride. Groom goes to the chuppah, bride goes to the chuppah. The ceremony begins with the bride circling the groom seven times. She walks around the groom seven times. Very mystical tradition. So this creates almost like a spiritual energy fortress around their future home together. Seven is significant in Kabbalah. There are seven emotional energies, 7 days of the week, seven heavens, seven natural forces. So all of this creating the spiritual energy around their future home together, symbolized by the chuppah. The chuppah symbolizes a home with a roof, with open walls. The idea is that it should be a place of safety and protection. Our home together, bride and groom, should be a place of safety and security, but it should have open doors and open walls for guests, and there should be no walls between husband and wife. Open communication, no secrets, no holding back. It should be, in a good way, right? Not to unload on the other, but in a good way, it should be open, flowing communication between, without the walls, without the separations. So these are some of the symbolisms of the chuppah, and then the ceremony unfolds. There's the ring that's given. There is the ketubah is read. We actually read the document for those assembled under the chuppah. There are blessings that are recited and some wine that is consumed, because you know every time we do a major mitzvah, it usually is associated with a glass or two of wine. Especially the life cycle events, a lot of them have to do with wine, like the bris milah, the circumcision, and the wedding. I guess those two. Bar mitzvah, kid doesn't have to drink wine. Okay, so that's that. So this discourse, this text that we're about to start, was said at the Kabbalah's Panim ceremony, at the time when the guests were assembled around the groom, right before the groom was going to go to the bride, the Rebbe in this context, the Rebbe before he was going to go to the Rebbetzin, so the Rebbe, Rabbi Menachem Endo Schneerson, before he was going to go to his soon-to-be wife, Rebbetzin Chaim Mushka, before he was going to go to her to put the veil on, so that's where this discourse was formally taught. But it was also written. And if you have, the books are coming next week, and if you want a book, just let me know, and I'll make sure to put one away for you. In the book, it's beautiful. You can actually see the handwriting of the previous Rebbe as he penned the discourse. This is the discourse. It's small, but you can see it. That's the Hebrew writing. You can see the Rebbe also, the previous Rebbe, he wrote in some things at the top. You know, like when you write a little bit of a, like an arrow thing, and you put words in between lines, and some lines are crossed out. It's interesting, but this is the written version in the Rebbe's own, in previous Rebbe's handwriting of his discourse. And then you also have, so that was said in 1928. December of 1928 is when they got married. The 14th day of Kislev. So to put into context, 11 days before Hanukkah. So December, winter of 1928 is when they got married, and that's when the first discourse was authored. The second discourse was taught by the Rebbe 25 years later, and he basically delivered a discourse that was an explanation on his father-in-law's discourse at his wedding. You with me on this? Does it make sense? So the Rebbe himself, 25 years later, shared a discourse, a teaching, that explores what his father-in-law said at his wedding. And then the transcript was typed up, and it was published formally 25 years after that on the 50th anniversary of the Rebbe's wedding. So 50 years after the Rebbe's wedding, the Rebbe's discourse as a commentary and his father-in-law's discourse was published. And here is the original edited version. You can see the typed manuscript and the Rebbe's edits in the handwriting on the second discourse. First things first. Let's jump into the first discourse. You guys ready?
I have one question.
Yeah.
For some reason, it's in my head that many long time ago, if the husband died,
yeah,
then the husband's brother was obligated to marry.
Yeah.
His
yeah. The Torah says that if a couple is married and they don't have children, and the husband passes away,
yeah,
so it's a mitzvah for the brother to marry the widow,
yeah,
and to have children with her to perpetuate the legacy of his brother, the deceased. Three generations right there. How beautiful.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, the brother has an option to not go ahead with it. Damon, you're earning a lot of points today. In a good way.
This is the most affectionate.
He's fantastic.
Child.
He's a great kid.
I am.
Very
well
in life. As his youngest. So
here's the thing. So the brother has the option. The brother can. That's so much easier than walking. The brother has the option. Sorry, the brother, it's a mitzvah. It's a good deed for him to do that. But he doesn't have to. He doesn't have to. And if he doesn't, if for whatever reason he can't or he doesn't want to, there's a process in which that connection, if you will, is broken, and then she can marry whoever she wants. She doesn't have to marry the brother if she doesn't like the brother. I'm saying, but it's an option.
Okay.
Think about it in a historical context. I think that's sometimes the easiest way to think about it. Think about it at a time when maybe it wasn't so easy to get married. And again, in those times, it was typically the husband that supported the wife and the kids. So think about it in that context. So somebody is a widow, God forbid, their husband passes away, they're young, they don't have children, who are they going to marry now? Who wants to marry? Maybe people didn't want to, I don't know, maybe people maybe that wasn't the first thing that people were looking for, is to marry a widow. Who knows? I don't know. So this was almost also a protection to say to the brother, look, the same mishpacha, the same family, your brother passed away. Let's continue the legacy of your brother. Marry her and whatever. But again, both sides could say, not for me. And then it's not for them. But it was in a way, again, another form of security or just mindfulness about the sometimes the potential precariousness, whatever the word is, of the situation. Okay. Now let's jump into the discourse. Now, what you're going to notice is, here's the thing. When you go into Barnes & Noble and you pull a book off the shelf that's about relationships and about marriage and about men and women and about gender and about communication and about intimacy and all those things, so you'll open up the book and it will speak directly to the topic. It's not going to speak in coded language. It's going to speak very clear and upfront. But we're studying the soul. So you're not going to hear necessarily the outside stuff yet. You're going to we have to jump into the soul of the stuff and then work from the inside out to understand how it applies to you and I, to real life, how it applies to us in our relationships. Okay? We start in a different place. Friday night davening, Friday night prayers. The Friday night service. Has a mystical angle on it. In virtually every synagogue around the world, they sing the Lecha Dodi prayer Friday night. But I don't believe that many Jews know that the Lecha Dodi prayer was actually authored by a Kabbalist, Rabbi Shlomo Halevi Alkabetz, in the 16th century, in the 1500s. He was one of the major Kabbalists that lived in the city of Tzfat in Safed, Israel. That was the hub, that was the home, if you will, of Kabbalah at that time in the 1500s. That was the hotspot. If you were a mystic, well, the mystics used to live in Spain until they couldn't, right? 1400s, in 1492, you had to get out. By 1492, you were expelled. So all the mystics of Spain, they basically went from Spain, some went to Portugal, but they went typically to North Africa. They went across the top from west to east, and many of them settled in Israel. And within Israel, they went to the hills, to the mountains of Tzfat. And in those hills and high places of Tzfat, they studied and they taught and they wrote and they explored and they practiced some of the practices and teachings of Kabbalah. That's where the Arizal lived. Rabbi Yitzhak Luria, Isaac Luria, the famed Kabbalist, the creator of Luriana Kabbalah, the author of Luriana Kabbalah. So he lived in Tzfat as well. And Shlomo Halevi Alkabetz, they all studied together. This large group of mystics, they were all there together. So the mystics used to go out to the fields Friday night. Friday as the sun set Friday evening. What's the Friday night service called? Kabbalat Shabbat. Kabbalah, again, Kabbalat Shabbat. Kabbalat Shabbat means to welcome Shabbat. They didn't just pray the evening prayers. They welcomed Shabbat. And they introduced various six different psalms, to get set before the Maariv, before the evening prayer, six introductory prayers, each one associated with one day of the week. A Sunday, a prayer recounting Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. And then the Lecha Dodi prayer, authored by the Kabbalist Rabbi Alkabetz. And he authored this prayer, deep, deep meaning, every stanza. You know, one day I'll have to do a class on the Lecha Dodi, analyze each stanza and the mystical meaning of it. I think that would be a good course. I have an idea for a new course. I want to do it. The Kabbalah of Lecha Dodi. So he authored this prayer, and it caught on wildfire. It's so beautiful. And in virtually any synagogue, even synagogues today that would not consider themselves Kabbalistic in nature. Do you guys, you might walk into a synagogue and ask them, do you teach Kabbalah here? Oh, no, we don't do Kabbalah. What do you do Friday night? Do you say Lecha Dodi? Do you know that that's a Kabbalistic work? That's authored by the Kabbalists. People don't know this, but that's where it comes from. It spread like wildfire, and everyone adopted it into their synagogues, into their prayer books, into their liturgy, because of how beautiful it is. It's a relatively young prayer. If you think of the prayers as being, you know, ancient, you know, thousands of years old, this prayer written in the 1500s, you know, it's 500 years old at this point, but it's not, you know, it's not in Talmudic times, so it's relatively new, but it's everywhere. So we're going to analyze the very first verse, the opening line of the Lecha Dodi. One of the more famous ways of singing it is Lecha Dodi. With the allergies, I can't sing. Lecha Dodi Lekra Kala Pene Shabbat Nekabala. So that's the refrain. Between each stanza of the prayer, we sing this opening line, the Lecha Dodi Lekra Kala Pene Shabbat Nekabala. So what does it mean? So let's read in the English. Let's go through it. Page 22. Everyone has a copy? Everyone's ready? Okay. with the help of heaven. Come, my beloved, to meet the bride. Let us welcome the Shabbat. So let's first explore what does it mean on a simple level, and then what it means on a much deeper level. On a very simple level, the individual is saying, come, my beloved. Who's beloved? Who's my beloved? With a capital B. Anytime we capitalize something, who does it refer to? Hashem. So we say, the person, you and I, every Friday night, we say, come, my beloved God, to meet the bride. Let us welcome the Shabbat. Who's the bride? Shabbat. So we say it twice. Come, my beloved. Come, God. Together, you and I. It's a very intimate way of referring to God. We don't say, God, help me understand the beauty of Shabbat. It's, come with me, God. Come, my beloved. Again, a lot of intimacy, very close. We're speaking to God in very intimate terms, calling God my beloved. Dodi. Dodi. Dodi, my beloved, the possessive term, my beloved, Dodi. And we say, come, lecha, let's go together. It's like, I'm going already, come with me. Come, my beloved, to meet the bride, lekrat, to meet the bride is Shabbat, let us welcome the Shabbat. So it says it twice. It's meet the bride and let us welcome the Shabbat. Of course, we could ask, why use both terms? Why use bride and Shabbat? And why is Shabbat called the bride? What's the significance of the fact that Shabbat is called bride? What's the significance? There's two elements to bride. Number one, it speaks of marriage, bride, in the context of groom and bride. And number two, it also speaks in the context of the feminine. Shabbat is referred to as the bride. We don't say, come, my beloved, let us welcome the groom Shabbat. It's the bride Shabbat. So we have marriage terminology, and we also have feminine terminology being used with regards to Shabbat. You with me on this? You see already what seems to be a simple opening line and a refrain that everyone sings in unison in many synagogues around the world. And you know, belts it out in harmony or not harmony or disharmony, whatever it is. So many layers, so many points of focus, of potential insight in these opening words. Okay. And just understand the context. I know I said this before, but again, this was authored by the Kabbalists, and they would say this, by Rabbi Alkabetz, and they would say this while literally in the fields. They wouldn't pray Friday night in the synagogue. They would go out into the fields and overlook the horizon as the sun was setting. And they would say, in that context, come, my beloved, to meet the bride. Let us welcome the Shabbat. They would be out in nature receiving, welcoming the onset of Shabbat and the approach of the Sabbath queen. So now the discourse begins. Well, that's the opening line, and now the analysis of the discourse begins. Shabbat is called bride, as in the above quoted passage. Shabbat is also called the queen, as in the saying, the Shabbat queen. There are other sources, other Kabbalistic texts that refer to Shabbat as Shabbat Malkata, the Sabbath queen, Shabbat queen. Not king, but the queen. So we have two things, two adjectives, synonyms, pseudonyms, I don't know, two other names for Shabbat. Both bespeak the feminine energy quality of Shabbat, either the bride or the queen. Is there a connection between the two, bride and queen? The answer is yes. Let's continue. The relationship between Shabbat and bride is underscored by the fact that in the case of a physical groom and bride, the groom is called king. As stated in Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer, chapter 16, quote, a groom is likened to a king, and the bride is called queen. There's an ancient Jewish teaching that says the following, that a groom, chatan and kala, a groom and a bride, are likened to a king and a queen. Chatan, the chasen, the groom, is dome lemelech, is like the king. And the kala, the bride, dome lemalka, she's compared to the queen. She's likened to the queen. Which is why, in our tradition, explaining, if you want to, again, if you want to know, I don't know if it's done in other traditions, so you'll help me out. All of you will help me out with this. I was going to say, now you're about to know another detail in the wedding procession, but maybe you won't. I don't know. That's, in the Jewish tradition at least, the groom and the bride are accompanied. They're not accompanied in a typical, they just walk by alone? Okay.
No, the bride is accompanied by her father. The groom is
by himself?
Comes out by himself.
Okay, well, in the classic Jewish tradition, both groom and bride are accompanied by shushvinin. Unterführers in Yiddish. It's those that are escorting them. Escorts, but that's right. Those that are escorting them down the aisle, whatever, toward the chuppah. It doesn't have to be an aisle, but toward the chuppah. The groom walks typically with parents. Some have that in some Jewish communities, they have it that the groom's parents walk him and her parents walk her. Some have it that the father's walk him and the mother's walk, or whatever, different traditions, it's all good. But they're accompanied by two people, one on the right and one on the left. Why? One of the reasons is because of this. Because a king and a queen, they don't travel alone. When the king travels, there's an entourage. And when the queen travels, there's also an entourage. So the groom, who's likened to a king, there's an entourage. And the bride, who's likened to a queen, there's also an entourage. They don't walk alone, right? There's Secret Service. There's security. There's the muscle, whatever it is, right? There's the guys with the earpieces, with the, right, with sunglasses. Whatever it is. I'm not suggesting that you have that theme, although anyone can, have fun with that. But the point is that the groom and the bride are a melech and malka, and I remember distinctly hearing this beautiful, like a one-liner almost, where there was a guy who was a yeshiva student who was engaged, and he learned this. And there are other things that we do because of this. When the groom walks in, let's say the wedding is happening, let's say there's a seated attendance. When the groom walks down the aisle, everyone's supposed to stand up. And when the bride's walking down the aisle, everyone's supposed to stand up. Why? Because you have a king and a queen. And you don't sit down in the presence of a king and a queen. So it's like when they're walking, when the thing starts, everyone can sit down. But when there's movement, you stand up out of respect, out of reverence. So I remember this line. There's a yeshiva student that once asked his teacher, so it says that a chassan, a groom, is a king. So how long am I a king for? The rabbi said, as long as you treat your wife as the queen. As long as you treat her as the queen, you can be a king. If you stop treating her like a queen, then what kind of king are you? So anyway, that's just like a one-liner. The point of this is that the Lechadodi prayer, it's not even a prayer, it's not even a song, it's a mystical insight, teaches us that what is Shabbat? Shabbat is a feminine energy that's likened to a bride, it's likened to a queen, and the bride is also likened to a queen. And now we can put some pieces together. We have three words that are all synonymous with each other. We have Shabbat, we have bride, and we have queen. And all three are interchangeable. So when we talk about core soul concepts, so we're not looking at the outside, because the outside is only a manifestation of the energy of the inside. The energy is a singular energy. It's expressed in different ways. In a relationship, it's a bride. In royalty, it's the queen. In days of the week, it's Shabbat. But it's all the same energy. So Shabbat, queen, and bride. Now, of course, this was said at a wedding. Right? At a wedding where they're about to walk to the bride, the queen, the Shabbat, and do what? Kabbalat Panim means welcome her, receive her. Right, everyone goes to receive the face of the bride. And then And then the veil, is put down over her face. But everyone's going to receive the Kabbalat Panim, the receiving of her face, if you will, the receiving of her countenance. Everyone is going to greet her. What does that sound like? Everyone greeting the Shabbat Queen, Shabbat, every Friday night. You with me on the connections here? Yes, sort of? Every Friday night, the Kabbalists at least would go out to receive, to behold, to see the Shabbat, approaching Shabbat. Likewise, at a wedding ceremony, there's a procession. Part of the pre-chuppah procession is where the groom and the others go to receive, to behold, to see the bride. That's all time we have for today. It's 11:05 already. Next week, we're going to pick this up. So this is just an introduction to what we're doing in general, and the opening lines, very few opening lines of the text itself. So we have this verse from the Lecha Dodi. We're starting to analyze it. We're starting to draw word comparisons or thematic comparisons. Feminine energy. We have bride. We have queen. We have Shabbat. And we have now, I introduced the correlation between receiving the Shabbat and receiving the bride at a wedding. And we'll understand what is the thematic, what is the essential connections between them. Okay, thank you for joining me today for Kabbalah and Coffee.